But the question is, can the human intellect really handle an acausal system?
That is a very good question. In mathematics, they are now finding out that there are some equations which drive themselves, in the sense that you do not anticipate the result. Whatever the mathematics will give you, it will give it. And so that has that acausal element. I sort of feel that it may have the acausal element. You know, there is a very interesting belief among physicists that God must be a mathematician. And of course, you know, the belief is that mathematics transcends reason.
I understand.
And mathematics transcends our causal system to that extent. So if mathematics someday is able to handle a causality, I would not be too surprised somehow.
Can you see that it does that? I mean,
not yet. Not yet. But you know, this mathematics is invented to
because it's still conceptual symbology,
yes.
And therefore it still is all mediated through, or at least perceived or formulated through the mind,
yes.
Through the intellect, through what's usually called the left hemisphere.
Yet, if we are part of one cosmic consciousness, then it makes sense. I mean, as you say very clearly, that the one becomes two in order to look at itself.
Yeah.
And in the state of two, it can look, and it can look at all the reality.
Yeah.
And that includes what its unitive aspect is. So from that point of view, I would not be too surprised if an unpredictive mathematics could handle this. And so long as it's unpredictive, I'm not surprised.
Unpredictive?
Unpredictive.
Oh, that's a nice one. Okay. Yeah.
I mean, all you have, you know, all Maharaj is telling us, and you have been telling us, is that we must admit the acausal. But this mathematics is acausal in that sense. If it turns out to be what I think it might turn out to be.
But it's interesting about the word apredictive, because when you are outside of time and space, you definitely understand that the future already exists. Now, how do you deal with the concept of apredictive in that?
And also, I don't know. Also, the tremendous difficulty that all of us have in understanding nonlinear time, the entire past, present, future existing together.
Yeah.
That's that by itself is a tremendous mystery to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
How do you think of that? Do you ever think of it, or just do you just experience it? It cannot be thought of, it seems like.
It feels as if, like when Einstein said, "I didn't arrive at my understanding of the fundamental laws through my rational mind," it seems to me what he's describing is a transcendent state in which he moves outside of the matrix of time and space into a more gestalt perception of the universe, which has in it past, present, and future. And then he comes back into his rational, linear, analytic mind, and his training as a physicist allows him to bring back from that totality some little sub-bit of information, just as Bach brings it back, or, you know, or is brought back in a rag or something like that. And that kind of knowledge is not something you can know, it's something you can be. Then you can only know about it as almost a memory. It's a memory trace. You can know a little bit about it.
Just witness how the knowledge or wisdom gets into your being.
Yeah.
And then you are aware of it.
Then it's coming out of your... That's like the difference between wisdom and knowledge. Knowledge is a much lower level game than wisdom is. Wisdom is a way of being in the universe. It's subjective, if you will. It's a subjective relationship. Knowledge is objective. And knowledge is really one step back. It's one thought away from being in the universe, if you will. It's always, that's where the separateness is.
That's right. And then that's where our feeling, basic feeling, comes from, of integrating the paradigms. Because in physics, we have acknowledged that subject-object division does not really exist in reality. And therefore, it is essential to mix them. But of course, the scientist is always scared. What happens if we mix them? Shall we ever find out what truth, namely, he's still thinking of objective truth, is? But at the same time, he realizes the paradox that there is no objective truth.
Yes, yes, yes.
So knowledge
now,
and wisdom.
Now, what does that mean? Does that mean that we have to change our what we mean by truth? Because it seems to me that what you know with the mind is only relative truth.
That's right.
And that absolute truth has no form to it.
That's right.
You know, it is not conceivable. Absolute truth isn't conceivable.
And the only way you can approach it is by being. And that state of being is, of course, what the Eastern practices are about. And the mystical practices are
that's
about.
That's what the basic distinction is between religion and science, if you will.
Yes.
You know? That's why, like in Western religions, God is inconceivable. It's like not even you can't even say the name. Because you can't get to that, you can't get that close.
That's right. In your tradition, did you grow up, you sort of grew up with that, didn't you? I
mean, yes.
That you cannot say the name of God.
Yeah.
I grew up in a system where, of course, God is everywhere, and whatever you are saying God.
Yes.
Most Hindu names
well,
are God.
Well, that's saying the same thing. It's just saying it from a different place.
Yes.
It's just saying it has no unique name.
That's right.
Because the minute you categorize it as that, it isn't that. You know?
But it's interesting how there are two ways of saying the same thing.
Yeah, exactly.
But both are... Doing this ritual, both are excluding the possibility of experiencing God in some extent. You know, this brings me to one question. In India, the system is really very elite, the spirituality bit, and people accept it. But in reality, they know that only a few people are going to be knowing God. And then they accept it, and that helps them with their karma. But they never venture to be it.
I understand.
Now, in science, of course, we do things very democratically. That is, if we have a realization, then we want it for everybody, like electricity.
Yeah.
How does that fit in?
Well, the Eastern, the security that comes with a paradigm that involves reincarnation makes it altogether different, because you understand that your turn will come and that you're playing your part. And that, like, I noticed in the 1960s when we first started to work with psychedelic chemicals, we expected every one of us to get enlightened at any second, right? Because that was the Western achievement. You can take it, grab it, and become that. And every time the question was whether it would happen at 10 or on Tuesday or when it would happen. And then we got a little, and I'd go to India, and I'd notice that none of the people that were around my guru ever talked about when they would get enlightened.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't understand it. Wasn't everybody wanting to get enlightened? And then I realized that time wasn't the dimension any longer.
That's right.
More was whether you were doing your part in the incarnation. And that's taken me years to learn. That is a certain humility that has come out of a deeper understanding of the timeless quality of time, in which time is a subsystem.
That's right. An existence where you live in space-time, yet there is a reality where space and time doesn't mean a thing.
Exactly. And that's why, even though the Eastern system looks elitist within the Western system, it isn't basically elitist. It's just as democratic. It's just a timing matter. Everybody is doing their part. You know, and if you were a good sweeper, a dharmic sweeper, you are doing the same as a king is doing, who's doing the king's dharma. You know, in the West, everybody wants to be the king, but in the East, everybody doesn't want to be the king. Everybody wants to do the dharma.
Beautifully put. So, what you're saying is that in space, the discrimination that becomes is one becomes divided into many, and in time, what happens is this what you just described, that not only one becomes many, but also the many plays different roles.
Different roles across time.
Across time.
Yeah. And then when it all gets telescoped back in, and then you're outside of time and space. Like, I would look, I'd see my guru looking at me, and he'd say things to me like, he'd say, Lincoln was a good president. I'd say, yes. He'd say, yes, because he knew Christ was president. He was only acting president. I'd say, yes. He'd say, did you know Lincoln? And I'd say, did I know Lincoln? You know, like Lincoln lived in 1860, you know. Or he'd look at me, and sometimes he'd say to me, Samat Guru Ram Dass. Now, Samat Guru Ram Dass lived in 1600.
That's right.
You know, and I began to think, is this man crazy? Or is it another possibility that he is telescoping incarnations? He's standing back where not only your past, present, and future in this life, but lives are all there. And he's just seeing the scope. And then for us to impose upon him the limits of our own sense information, is exactly where the whole thing becomes absurd.
Particularly when you realize that, not only just a series of lives, but every life that ever happened is all our own incarnations.
It's all us. And that's, Jung was approaching that with his collective unconscious, the concept of collective unconscious. That's as close as we could get in the West with that idea.
Actually, I have a feeling that we probably will be going further with it. I mean,